Okay, any questions or comments for Cy? I guess I would recommend the way we handle this is since we've gone through a technical presentation relative to the first part, is that when you do bring this back for closure, that maybe we cover it at a high level, just to refresh everybody and focus on the part that is not completed yet, and then deal with that in that way. If that makes sense, Joe.
Sure. And one more thing, Cy. We do have a package on this that's been presented to us by the program office. So we will work from that and have them update that package as well as we go.
Okay, so you have looked at that. You think you understand what else you'll need in conjunction with the meeting in January to be able to close, get a complete closure package.
That's right.
Okay. Okay.
Next is the external tank, and Richard Kors will take us through that and where we are.
Okay, is this chart, the first chart says this is a status. We're not recommending any type of closure on this item. This is the basic CAIB recommendation, and the thing you pointed out yesterday, Dick, this says eliminate all external tank thermal protection system debris at the source with particular emphasis on the bipod struts, which they've done. But the next chart is really what the program has done is the program manager sent out direction to all of the projects to go look at any debris coming off the SRB, coming off the pad, and also the ET project and the systems integration people have included ice on the tank as well. So it's bigger than thermal protection. All the projects, to my knowledge, have reported back to the program manager essentially saying that there's no debris sources, critical debris sources coming off the other elements. Things like butcher paper and things like that are from the arbiter are being removed. Next chart. This is a chart we've seen before, but this is basically the activity going on at the ET project. The upper left-hand corner, it's hard to read, but basically all critical debris is coming off the side of the tank that faces the arbiter. So it's the top of the tank, and the ET project has addressed each of these areas. If you see in the center upper is the intertank flange, and you'll see some divots for us. These are in-flight photos off of the recovered arbiter wheel well cameras from previous flights. I'm not sure what flight this came off of, but it gives you an idea of where divots were removing. This whole area has been cleaned out plus or minus 105 degrees around the tank. And new processes have been developed, and the stringers going up, you see those vertical lines, there's those stringers. There's been a new technique developed to insert foam into the lower portion of the stringers. I reported last week or early this week that this activity for the LH2 flange has been completed on the next flight tank. The right side, upper right, is the bipod fitting. The piece you see there was typical of STS-107. That ramp has been removed on subsequent flights, beginning with the return to flight, and a set of heaters have been installed to compensate for the TPS thermal protection for ice prevention. The lower left hand is there, if you look down the feed line that pumps propellant into the tank, there's three bellows, which are like little accordions that allow the tank, it stretches or shrinks about 4 or 5 inches during the tanking, so you've got some bellows in there to compensate for the movement of the tank structure. These bellows, though, during pre-launch, during tanking, develop Delta ice, and what you see here is a picture from a previous flight. And what NASA actually has seen was in some of the CIB report photos is some of this ice has actually made us all of us has made it all the way to orbit. And from some of the camera photos from the orbiter, you'll see ice in some of these bellows. There's three bellows. There's one forward, up just where the inner tank is located, and then there's two aft near the aft orbiter interface. The center lower is just a photo of one of the recommendations was to look at non-destructive inspection or non-destructive testing. That originally, the first two or three times we met, was one of the primary means that they were going down the path for certification. It has turned out that didn't materialize quite as fast, although they just did some more non-destructive inspections on a replaced PAL ramp, and talking to the ET project the last couple of days, that data's looked pretty good, but they are not using that data as part of certification. It's for confidence testing, and they're going to continue to look at NDI development in future applications or future tanks. The other area on the right lower is what Forrest mentioned, which you see there is a ET camera installation, which is there to take photos of the orbiter. It basically will look at the orbiter right side wing, because this camera is a little bit skewed to the right as you're going up. And that whole camera installation is complete. All of the certification is complete, and it's ready to fly. Next chart. What the NASA did, or the ET project did, they broke their recommendation into three, debris shedding into three areas. Phase one was to go after known sources of debris and make sure that all the right verification and certification was being done. Phase two is beyond return to flight. It looks at enhancements, and I got a chart that talks about them a little bit. Phase three was long-term, and based on the space exploration initiative that says the shuttle's going out of business, if you will, in 2010 or after the completion of ISS assembly, that activity has been deferred, and there's no plans currently. And these are things like going to a smooth tank or going to a complete cover that would completely cover the feed lines and come up with a new way to verify the TPS applications. Next chart. Critical debris, it's like I showed on the pictorial, forward bipod fitting, the foam blocks have been taken off, heaters have been added, have gone through the verification process, intertank LH2 flange, that whole area of 115 degrees on each side was removed. It's been reinstalled on the new processes. The feline bellows ice elimination, that is an area that is still does not have a final configuration or a final analysis. What they have done is added what they call a drip lip, and the drip lip essentially lets the ice or the moisture come out and drip off the tank rather than forming. Tests they've run both at Marshall Space Flight Center and Eglin Air Force Base in their environmental chamber is that the drip lip, depending on the weather conditions and the humidity, is eliminated probably 45 to, say, 75% of the ice buildup. Whether this is adequate or not is still being analyzed. The ET project is working on a backup heater system to apply to the bellows. Like I mentioned earlier, there's three bellows. They're looking, and the forward bellows being closest to the underbelly of the orbiter is one that would be a higher priority. The aft bellows, when you look at the transport analysis from the systems integration people, the likelihood of impact in the bottom of the orbiter is less than the forward bellows. That is open work, and that's one reason we're leaving this one open, because we still need to see that open work and what the final recommendation and final hardware fix or analysis fix is going to be, or what they recommend. Phase two is redesign or eliminate LO2 and LH2 PAL ramps. What the CAIB recommended is that, I think in one of the findings, is to go back and look at that, what the ET project has done both here at Marshall and in Tullahoma in the wind tunnel have run different configurations of PAL ramps. Current configuration to get the baseline data all over again. Modified PAL ramps that are different heights are completely eliminating the PAL ramps. And right now the preliminary inputs coming back is that probably with some more testing may be able to completely eliminate the PAL ramps that are going up the side of the vehicle. And the reason is this is manually applied foam. I mentioned earlier looking at NDI technology as they go forward, always looking at process controls and better ways to close out the manual applications, and always looking at better analysis tools to better size and reduce TPS on the vehicle. So this is ongoing activity in phase two. Next chart. The approach that the ET project is taking is they're employing what they've termed a lead tank and a trail tank. The lead tank is the first tank for a return to flight. It's ET tank 120. As I mentioned earlier, the hardware fixes except for the bellows will be complete by the end of this week or early next week. Then the project is going through a phase design certification approach. Chuck talked about his DCR for his bolt catcher. Every NASA project, when they go through a design review, culminate this in a design certification approach where you're saying I've met all of my requirements and I can show you how I verified and how I'm certifying them. What they did is they broke it up into two DCRs, DCR 1, which is going on last week and this week. I talked to the ET project yesterday. I think the pre-board is today, I think. But they did not deal with TPS. They dealt with things like the GUCP, which is the ground umbilical carrier plate. It's where the electrical and the purge go through the side of the inner tank. There were some minor modifications there to accommodate the new heaters going in for the forward bipod. SRB bolt catcher, what Chuck showed you, is that ET, that bolt catcher is actually on the ET. So even though the SRB project was responsible for the design, but the bolt catcher is mounted on the ET. So ET project has to go back and do a design certification that they satisfied themselves that they've met the requirements. Camera system will be included in the first DCR. Any non-TPS re-verification activities, any redesigned non-TPS hardware, and then they always go through open actions that they've had from the program level program requirements control board, PRCB. DCR2, which will deal with the TPS, is scheduled the end of January through the 1st of February or the 4th of February, but the board for this is not going to really culminate until about mid-March. So that's when all of the material from DCR 1 and 2 will come together, go through all the reviews at Marshall and the ET project and the system, and come up with a final certification. This trail, and then in case something happens in this verification process, because they have shipped the tank to the Cape before this is all complete, at least the DCR2, the trail tank will not be shipped from the Michoud assembly site until they've completed the DCR and feel that they've certified the vehicle for flight. If anything comes up, they'll go back and modify the trail tank. Next chart. I think I covered this. Basically, ET project feels they've certified the materials, certified the applications. There's still some additional testing and analysis that has to go on. And if you look down below here on the open work for certification, they feel there's none for DCR phase one, but there's still stress thermal analysis, demonstration tests, and acceptance criteria still needs to be developed for the for the Phase 2 DCR. Next chart. We've had a series of meetings going way back. Dick, I guess we met about the first week this group was formed. We went down to Michoud. We've been back there four or five times. We've had a number of telecons, and our last status meeting, November 9th and 10th, the tech panel was at Michoud, and Dick Covey was there, and I think, Dan, you were there as well, to witness some of the applications of the closeout. We saw two-person closeouts. We saw them spraying the inner tank and spraying the forward bipod. Next chart. Summary status. We think the ET project has done a heck of a lot of tremendous work over this last year and a half. I think what they're completing this week and before they ship is all the hardware mods except for the bellows mod. And once the tank gets to the Cape, it goes through a normal integrated launch preparation process. The tank gets to the Cape, they have to raise it from horizontal to vertical, put it in its test cell, go through a series of closeouts, and then they really won't stack this ET to the tank, I mean to the ET to the SRBs until they've completed the Phase 2 DCR. So we also believe that the tank has developed an aggressive plan to eliminate the critical debris. We feel that they've done everything possible, and what is open, as I say again, is the bellows. So our overall recommendation is we keep this open, and I think we need to look at the results from the DCR too.
Dick, is it accurate to say that the the program has assessed all those areas on the tank where ice classically forms during tanking,
right,
and they've selected areas that they're concerned about either to put in a heater or drip lip or whatever, and they have accepted all those other areas where we know there will be ice?
Right now, but it still doesn't work. As an example, the aft umbilicals. There's always been some ice formation there, sure. So it's still going back and looking at that and looking at the debris transport analysis, because that's pretty far back, and the velocity, I mean, is you may come close or impact the body flap, but most of that is sure. Aft.
But
you're right.
Still looking at that?
Hmm?
As if
they're still looking
okay,
at that.
So they haven't bought off
yeah.
all that.
And they're working yeah. it with the transport analysis people, Muratar's SCNI people, to come to grips on the transport analysis, and then come to the grips on the probability okay. assessment. That's still ongoing.
Yeah. Thanks.
I think, Bob, the forward bipod with these heaters, that's probably eliminated the ice. I mean, that was the intent, and I think all the testing analysis they've done at Marshall and Eglin has shown that so far. You know, you get itself a little bit into the temperature and humidity effects.
Well, and as you mentioned, there's other areas where they do manual closeouts on the tank with foam that we know right. we classically get ice. Right.
And I mentioned yesterday there's a few open items, like they put some new PDL foam, which is a new foam for filling in some bolt holes, if you will.
Sure.
And that's got a requirement that it can't absorb water. So there's some testing that's got that PDL stuff sitting out in the moisture, and they have to go back and pull it out and see if it absorbed any moisture. In the past, it hasn't, but that's part of this verification cycle, just to give you an example.
Mr. Chairman, I have an admission to make, maybe for the first time in public. I'm overly infatuated with math models. Which probably means I need therapy. But as an economist, I've built them, used them, evaluated them, and more importantly, suffered the consequences of relying on them too much. And both Cy and Dick have referred to some of the analytical testing that's going on and in preparation for return to flight. And I'm a little concerned about some of the use of those models as they come together for end-to-end risk analysis, but also in the threat or the potential is that we delude ourselves into knowing something we don't know. and that a point estimate, which has very broad bands of uncertainty around it, becomes something that we rely upon. And I just thought it's worth having a little discussion maybe to talk about what these models are being used for and how they may be employed. For example, and I'd ask the tech panel, I guess that these models are not going to be used for real-time in-flight determination or analysis. Is that the case? And if so, then what does that tell you about how we should rely upon them for certification or risk analysis or any other pre-flight activities?
What we've been informed, and as of this week, is that the operations people do not intend to use the models to make assessments of where they should not go out and look. For instance, if the model said it predicts a non-critical impact and they think they have an impact, they're going to go look anyway. So they're not going to rely on this to eliminate, make real-time flight decisions in terms of that. They are intending to use the transport models to say, if I see a piece of debris, here's where it might have hit. So it would be an area where they could go off and look for what that damage might have been. But we had no indication that they would be using them for real-time flight decisions.
So what should we be using them for? How should we rely upon them before flight?
That is the subject for open debate at this time. And as you know, we've had an ongoing discussion with the people who are developing these models, and it is not one model. It is a series of models, everything from liberation models that start from where the debris is liberated to transport models for how the debris flies, to impact models, which are kinetic energy models of what it hits, to thermal models as to what that damage would result in from a thermal standpoint, to structural models as to what it would refer to from a stress standpoint. It's a combination of models which are being developed by different people and are, in order to understand the end-to-end process, have to in some manner be connected so that you can understand how these things happen. All of these models were originally developed to be deterministic models. And so if we time warp back about 4 months, all of these models, the transport models, the hundreds of millions of runs that were run, were all deterministic runs. The impact analysis was deterministic analysis. I have an impact at a certain instance angles with a certain velocity and a certain mass resulting in a certain effect. So they were all deterministic models. Subsequent to the last 4 months, they have stepped off into other areas, including simulation to try and couple models and even probabilistics to try to understand what the likelihood of events are. The maturity on both those things is about 4 months old. So it's a concern, I think, which is shared by a number of members of the task group as to how we go about this process and how much confidence we have in it once we've gone about it. There's no doubt that we know a heck of a lot more about what debris is and how it flies than we ever did before as a result of the very diligent work that's been done by the program in understanding the way debris flies and the way debris impacts. I think it's an open question as what you end up with at the end of the day.
Most analytical models I'm familiar with are fairly sensitive to the assumptions, and obviously the output is only as good as the quality of the assumptions. Are these models sensitive to that as well?
They are very sensitive to assumptions and ground rules, which are dynamic in nature. These are at each debris summit that we have attended, we have seen an evolution in the ground rules and assumptions that are being used on the models as well as the tools themselves. In a September time frame, as I indicated, they were deterministic models. Subsequent to that September time frame, they added a Monte Carlo simulation along with ground rules about and assumptions about how those operate. They're, as Mr. Cosopoli just indicated to me, there is discussion ongoing as to the degree to which these models can be used for certification for the vehicle and an integrated debris environment. I think that's an open question. There is one more activity in January, which is another attempt to talk about how you can combine these various models that Mr. Rubenstein is going to be at, possibly myself. The models are very complicated. In many cases, they are new models to the people who are using them. For instance, the Dynacode impact models are relatively new models to the NASA environment. Therefore has somewhat immaturity with them.
Chuck, can I pipe in here a little bit from an operational perspective?
Sure.
And talk about this in terms of pilot language.
Yeah.
And not mathematical engineering language. The way I understand this model thing is there are tools that are almost always used in an operational scenario in conjunction with some sort of other data anchor point. Like if you had a photo of a divot out of a tank, the model might help you guess where the thing went. And if you had a damaged point at some place on the orbiter, the model might help tell you where or guess where it came from. Or you use it to determine a trajectory of a because it gives you kind of a guess at the transport mechanism, which you have some level of confidence in. So it kind of you use it to narrow down things. Am I wrong with that?
That's
one use.
Yeah, the operations people have indicated they will use the models in that regard. That they will use it to basically say, this is where we should go look.
Right.
But if I've understood what Chuck was saying as well, if the model suggested there wasn't an impact, they may well not accept that as the outcome. I mean, in other words, they may still go inspect.
Certainly, if there were contradictory
data. You'd
have
to verify it.
That's
somehow.
Right. They would not eliminate a focus look based on that. But in addition to that, some of what the models have been used for is to expand on the experimental data. I mean, as you well know, as an experimental scientist, I want to lay hands on it before I believe it. And models are, you know, just as good as the input you have. But a lot of the testing that's being done is really difficult to do to try to set up an actual scenario. And what happened at the first debris summit is they started to try to mold these models in order to get at things that they don't know how to do. And one of the answers at the end of the first debris summit was not good enough. Go back and see if you can figure out a way to really recreate a more realistic scenario. And then when you've done that, see if your model matches. And if it does, you can begin to depend on the model a little bit more. And so that interaction, this is not news to NASA and the people doing this, that the models are not exactly the right thing that will give you every answer, but they're trying to use them as an additional tool to validate, to extend their resources. And so I think they are looking at it in the right frame of mind and how to use them.
One of the things, if I heard Cy correctly say, was that they haven't yet really validated the models with flight data. And that's something
correct.
That would seem to
correct.
Me to be...
Well, it's a major activity undergoing to get the flight data characterized.
Yeah.
So you can understand what it really means and you can understand the difficulty. The flight data is end result at basically landing. So the intermediate stages of where did it come from and
right.
how did it transport don't exist.
And it is not for certain at this time that the people developing the integrated models, the SE9, will actually mm-hmm. use the flight data. They have on several occasions indicated that the variability in which the flight data was gathered and the variability in which the data is available over the various flights makes it difficult to put it into an environment to correlate against the model.
One of the biggest problems that occurs is the transport analysis says you can almost lose a piece from anywhere it'll hit any place. And you don't know how to bound it.
Exactly.
Let me put this in proper perspective. The CABE recommendation was that NASA needed to do more modeling.
They have.
They've succeeded.
And we're getting modeling. And when that opened that door, you can hardly ever close it. And the engineers love to test. They love to make analysis. And it'll keep on. And There'll be an end to this when they run out of money or something. But the modeling is being effective right now. I think it's what they're doing. But the question is, and the program office has got to come to grips about what they're used for, like you all talked about, and decide when they had enough. And it's the toughest thing on a program when you're being a program manager is to turn off the engineering. It is a real hard decision because they have a very convincing story every time you turn around that extra data is really needed. And based on the CABE recommendation that we didn't have enough modeling, NASA is making sure they have plenty. So that's the problem we have.
As I start out saying, my largest concern, I mean, you've got potential of questions of resources and time before return to flight that's up to the program, clearly in NASA. My concern for us is that we don't, nor NASA, on behalf of NASA, read more into the results than we ought to, that we rely on them somehow that's inappropriate. And I'm assuming that in this case, like all of the economic models I work with, when you start plugging models together and trying to link them, we have a concept, well, at least one, called joint probability, which means as you start putting these things together, the probability, the distribution, the certainty gets less because you're taking uncertainty from one model, plugging it into another model and yet another. And so these bands become very, very wide. And you're talking about, you know, 1 plus or minus 100 when you're done. So we can't rely on the point estimates very well that come from these serially linked models, even if we had very good empirical data to justify the assumptions we made for each, which I think is not always the case here either. So I'm just concerned that we don't, as you said, engineering is hard to turn off. This may be a little beyond engineering into the ethereal gases of I've got a computer and I can run it. And we shouldn't be overly reliant on those results.
Let me ask a question relative to this. Have we seen evidence that that NASA has not recognized the limits of their modeling and is consequently using the models inappropriately? I don't think I've heard that, but I want to ask that question because we've had a lot of talk about it yet.
We have not heard that they're using it inappropriately. We have heard that they are using them inconsistently. We have heard stories, for instance, the discussion with the operations people says, we will not use these models to make real-time flight decisions. And that is their use of the model environment. We have not heard from the program if the program at the end of the day wants to do a certification for the end-to-end system based upon these models. So the end use of the model is somewhat undetermined at this time. Now, the models have yielded a lot of information, which is valuable information. It allows us to characterize, better understand the physical environment in which this vehicle is operating. Better than we ever did before. But I also share Dan's concerns that we do not put an over-reliance on the absolute answer being provided by